No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/hailmary. That's hims.com/hailmary for your free online visit. hims.com/hailmary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
All right, welcome to the show. Others receiving votes. I'm Pam Forty with my colleagues, as usual, Gene Wojciechowski and Brian Fisher. We're heading into the stretch drive of the season, gentlemen. And here's what we're going to cover on today's show. We're going to do what comes naturally, which is second-guessing the playoff committee and their first rankings.
Okay.
Decide which program is closest to being an every-year playoff participant, or is there any such thing as one that could do it every year? We'll dissect the Hugh Freeze flop at Auburn and who should be next on the Plains. We'll check in on some anger in Boston. We'll make some game picks. I will pretend last week never happened in that regard. And we'll have more holiday creep. But first, guys, before we get to that, I did want to bring your attention to this. Matt Brown from Extra Points did some work on which stadiums, which colleges are selling the most beer at their games or most alcohol. And his original reporting said that the university in Madison, Camp Randall Stadium, the Badgers, was number one. Gene, what's the name of that school?
Oh, man. Wisconsin.
There we go. Yeah, this was all an elaborate setup to get Gene to say Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
I'm easily amused.
Okay.
Anyway, Matt's reporting was actually in error, and he corrected it, as a good reporter would. He had last year's numbers, and apparently since people aren't going to the Wisconsin games, they're not selling as much alcohol. Nebraska, congratulations. You are the drinkingest fan base in-game right now.
So, and with good reason.
Yeah, and Dylan Rayl is injured, and they just lost at home to USC. They have plenty of reason to continue drinking. Okay, on with the show. Fellas, we got that out of Gino. We can move on happily now. We had the CFP reaction Tuesday night. Gene was, I think, getting a spa treatment. Brian Fisher and I did a live reaction. We thank all 14 people that watched. It was, as usual, interesting, revelatory, gave us some stuff to complain about, and it sets off the five-week bitch fest that I think undermines the credibility of the committee, but that's their decision. The top 12 as follows. This is what we're talking about here. We have number one, Ohio State. Number two, Indiana. Number three, Texas A&M. Number four, Alabama. Number five, Georgia. Number six, Ole Miss. Number seven, BYU. Number eight, Texas Tech. Number nine, Oregon. Number 10, Notre Dame. 11 and 12, Texas and Oklahoma, but they wouldn't be in the playoff right now because you'd have to have an ACC champion, which would be Virginia, and you have to have a group of six champion, which would be unrated Memphis. Virginia is number 14. So that's the lay of the land. Brian and I had plenty to say about this the other night. So, Gino, let's hear from you. What are your biggest takeaways on the first reveal of the top 25?
Well, I think the first one is I'm not going to get my boxers in a bunch over the very first CFP rankings. I do believe a lot of this plays itself out in the next few weeks. But I'd be really interested if one of you at least can explain to me why the committee took into account the head-to-head results of, and I've written them down here, Texas OU, Alabama, Georgia, Ole Miss, Georgia, Virginia, Louisville, but somehow have decided that the Notre Dame-Miami head-to-head disappeared on them.
Yeah.
Miami lost to Louisville and SMU. Notre Dame lost to Texas A&M and, wait for it, Miami.
Yeah.
Miami is cleaning the basement crawl space at number 18, is it? And Notre Dame's upstairs at number 10. And can you explain to me why Notre Dame is ranked ahead of Oklahoma and Texas when both OU and Texas, in my humble opinion, have better wins than Notre Dame? Texas beat OU in Dallas, Vandy in Austin. Their losses are to number one Ohio State. And yes, there's that bad one at Florida. OU has beaten number 21 Michigan and number 25 Tennessee, which I'll admit, I don't quite know why Tennessee's ranked in the top 25. And their losses are to Texas and Ole Miss. And why Louisville, which by the way beat Miami and only has one loss, is five spots behind Notre Dame. And Notre Dame's best win is at home against USC. So I'll hang up and I'll listen to your answers.
Brian, you want to handle that?
Well, I think if you address the key question there with Notre Dame and Miami, a lot of it just has to come down to just the way the committee works and not having Notre Dame come right up against Miami. I think that gap between those two means that they were not on the same page with the committee in terms of on all their screens in that room in Dallas. You know, it was not Miami versus Notre Dame versus all those other ones that were. And so they could have readjusted, even if they had, say, a Louisville ahead of Virginia, they could have swapped those on the final ranking. So that's the dive into how the committee works, I think, is the biggest thing. I'm with you, Gino, though. It doesn't make sense to have Miami that low. And, you know, the committee chair, Mac Rhodes, he kind of came out afterwards and said, you know, look, it's consistency with the Canes. You know, they just didn't see it. And all those turnovers these last couple of weeks that have led to a lot of these losses, I think that was a big factor. Yeah. And just the way Miami has been playing, you know, even going back to some of those wins, you go back to that Florida State game, right? They jump out to a big lead. They let the Noles get back into things. Even Notre Dame, I mean, that was a one-way traffic for about 3.5 quarters. And then Notre Dame got back in that game. They needed the late field goal. So this is a Miami team that I think the committee respects the talent there. We can all see it. They pass the eye test in that front, especially in the trenches with those guys that they have that are going to be first round picks. But the consistency on the field has not been there for the Canes. And I think that's, they almost got punished in these first committee rankings as a result.
Yeah. Gino, well, thank you. Welcome to, you can join me in the bunker as the Notre Dame fans besiege us since I've kind of,
I got nothing against Notre Dame.
No, I don't either.
You know, me either. I mean, you either. So it's just, it's, you asked me what was my takeaway. That was one of them.
I know. And that's it. Nobody has anything against Notre Dame. They're just rated too high. That's it. And I think the biggest reason why, guys, is their losses were at the beginning of the season and they just seem to magically matter less. There is a recency bias, no matter what anybody says about what happens. And so you've seen Notre Dame do nothing but win since September 13th. And you think, well, gosh, they're really good. And they are, but this is supposed to be a full season resume.
Yeah.
Right? There's only 12 games. So they need to all matter, especially the games against the best teams, which is what those were. And Brian, you were there for the Miami-Notre Dame game. I thought Miami was the better team all day. Yeah. It was a close game, good game. I was there for the Texas A&M game. It was an absolute shootout, back and forth, jump ball kind of game. It came down to the last play, but it wasn't like, you know, either way, that neither team was vastly superior to the other, but it was a loss. They lost at home.
Yeah.
That has to matter. And that's where I think just the committee, various factors come into play. But I think in this instance, losing your games early, that's been the best thing Notre Dame has done the last couple of years. I mean, you lose to Northern Illinois, that's terrible. But if you do it early, hey, it was a long time ago. People tend to forget. So, that's my theory there. But yeah, Notre Dame's ranking to me jumped out as not in line with those around them and behind them. Brian, on Tuesday night, Wednesday over to overnight into Wednesday. You wrote about the Big 12's beatdown of the ACC in the rankings. Why did it go down that way? And what can the ACC do in the next month to change its standing?
Well, you know, a lot of this just comes down to they didn't get it done in that non-conference schedule. You know, I think that's the key factor that I took away from not only Mac Rhodes' comments, but just kind of looking at those rankings. And look, you know, the Big 12 was 6-1 against the ACC in the non-conference. I think that head-to-head factor, whether it was conscious or whether it was unconscious in that committee room, definitely played a factor in terms of not only bunching everybody up in the ACC, but making sure they're way behind the Big 12, not just the leaders in the Big 12, but also Utah there as another one of those two lost teams that the ACC was behind. And, you know, look, the ACC, you know, the Big 12 went 8-6 in non-conference play. The ACC was 5-14 against the other Power Four leagues and Notre Dame. So like that kind of puts it in pretty stark contrast. You know, they had a pretty good week one, all things considered. You know, Florida State upset Alabama. Obviously, Miami beat Notre Dame that we were just talking about. And you kind of thought, all right, maybe the league's got a little bit of momentum, but they just kind of completely let that go. And then you add on the conference losses that have come lately, and the ACC has a lot of work to do. And I think, you know, there is going to be that debate between the Big 12 and the ACC in terms of which is going to be the multi-bid league. Right now, the Big 12 has a leg up, but there are a lot of scenarios out there for the ACC to kind of get back in this. You know, Louisville is going to be key. I mean, there could be, if you look at the standings, you look at the schedules coming up, there could be a four-way tie atop the ACC standings, which number one is a huge headache for the committee in terms of, all right, here's who's going to Charlotte. That's one bid. Maybe you have a Louisville out there that doesn't even make it to Charlotte for the ACC championship game, but they still have one loss. All right, there's another way for the ACC to get in multiple teams. So it's not over by any stretch for Jim Phillips' league, but they better be out there stumping, getting the speeches ready, starting to campaign a little bit, even though we're past election day right now, in terms of saying, hey, we're still a good league. We can still get multiple bids, but there needs to be some work done on the field. And I think it starts these upcoming next 2 weeks. I think that'll be key for the ACC in terms of at least changing the narrative a little bit, because they got put behind the eight ball in the non-conference slate.
I agree. I think that especially the head-to-head with the Big 12, which the Big 12 smartly marketed the hell out of themselves beating up on the ACC. They put it out in there every week when they'd send out this week in the Big 12. Here's our record against the ACC. And, you know, there's where little kind of mileposts, like Baylor winning at SMU early. And that was a game where they had to make a semi-miraculous comeback to do it. But it counts. It matters. And Baylor is right now kind of a mid-pack Big 12 team. And SMU's still in the hunt to go to Charlotte. And they can look at that and say, yeah, look, one of our mid-pack teams beat one of their upper-tier teams. And by the way, the selection committee chair is the Baylor AD. He might have brought that up. You're right. The scenario of a four-way tie and who gets in and who doesn't get in to go to Charlotte is fascinating. And what might be the benefits of not playing in a championship game? People here in Louisville, I live in Louisville, and they're trying to decide whether 11-1 would be better than 11-2, you know, or 11-1 is, you know, is that good enough to get in on its own, or is it win the title or bust? So there's a lot of angst there. Gino, you have any thoughts on the ACC situation?
Well, I was going to ask you a little bit about Louisville. You just answered most of it. I mean, there is a scenario where they can end up with just one loss, and that one loss is a three-point loss to UVA.
Yep.
Why would you not? I mean, why wouldn't you want to win every one of your games? That makes no sense to me. I also think, to Brian's point, yes, the Big 12 has won the primary. Now we have the general election. And there's still a pathway for Georgia Tech, for example. They win at BC. They win versus Pitt. Then they have that monster game against Georgia at Mercedes-Benz in Atlanta.
Yeah.
They have an 11-1 record with a win against a top five team. At least their top five team right now, Georgia is. Or what happens if Pitt goes on a season-ending bender and heater? And look, you know, they're playing Notre Dame, Georgia Tech, Miami. All three of those teams right now are in the top 18 of the CFP rankings. They'd be 10-2. And again, they do have that gruesome loss to West Virginia, but they can make a case. So I don't think it's over for the ACC. I think there are still pathways. Not saying it's going to be super easy, but I'm not ready to give up on them yet.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, that's the one league that still has some major non-conference games left. Not just the games between the ACC and the SEC, but the Notre Dame game for Pittsburgh that can really give them some added late-season credibility.
In Georgia.
The Georgia Tech game is potentially huge for a number of reasons. But also, speaking of early-season losses that just seem to go away, Alabama losing to Florida State, which is now like in 14th place in the ACC. That hasn't held them back at all. Again, it's good to lose early in this sport. One other thing, guys, after listening to Mack Rhodes talk, you know, on the teleconference after the TV show, and boy, will Mack hate this job by, you know, a few weeks from now when he's still doing this. But one of the things that came out to me is this seems like a committee that's big on the look test. There was a lot of talk about turning on the tape and seeing how they look and line play and this and that. Does this mean that the coaches on the panel, Chris Ault, Mark D'Antonio, Mike Riley, are holding sway? Maybe some of the former players too. Wesley Walls, former tight end at Ole Miss, is on the committee. Yeah, is this a football guys committee, or is this a resume committee, I think is the question. My opinion, it sounds to me like a football guy committee, and we've had that in the past where Alvarez and Tom Osborne kind of took charge and I think really kind of steered where things were going. Might not be a bad thing, might be a good thing. I tend to want people who are more into the resume and tell me, you know, can interpret that. I don't want to hear Mack Rhodes tell me whose offensive line is better. He's an athletic director at Baylor. That's to me, and he may just be passing along what everyone else is saying, but I don't want a committee that's going to say, you know, the duo blocking clearly separates Alabama from the competition. I'm not into that, but what do you guys think there?
Well, I'd agree with you. You know, I think that it's interesting to see those coaches too, and obviously having interactions with them over the years. I don't anticipate, you know, Mike Riley, as nice as he is, being just the vocal leader in that group. But I could see, you know, somebody like Mark D'Antonio, you know, kind of being a little bit more vocal, being a little bit more out there with his opinion, and then that might get Chris Ault on board. You know, and I think it might be a more of a momentum thing, you know, with those coaches. Somebody speaks up and says one thing and then everybody kind of nods and agrees. And then that kind of carries the tenor of the room right there. And so I think that might be where we comes in, because it definitely seemed like the eye test prevailed in those first set of rankings. You had Ohio State over Indiana, which had the superior resume. You know, you had Georgia ahead of Ole Miss, obviously with the head-to-head, but, you know, Georgia was that number five team. And, you know, you look at Alabama, you know, if you look at the resume that they put in terms of the number of top 25 wins, there could have been a case for Alabama to be ahead of Texas A&M, but it wasn't. So I think for a lot of those coaches in there, they kind of held sway in terms of, all right, this is the first set of rankings. We don't have the complete set of data right now. Let's go with the eye test. This team was better than this team. And then because they make it up as they go along all the time and on the CFP show itself. And then afterwards in the teleconference with the media, all right, well, we're going to figure out ways we can justify ranking team A ahead of team B.
Well, I guess I will semi-defend the committee here. Without us actually being in the room, who knows what unfolded there and who's holding sway. But I think there are worse things than having former coaches and former players inform the non-coaches and non-players in that room about what they see and what impresses them and what they like about this team. And we can call it the eye test, or we can call it informed opinion. But then it's up to the other committee members to take that information, process it, and use it in their own rankings. And I suspect that's probably what happens, but Brian makes a good point. You know, you certainly, if you're using the eye test or the coaches and former players test, maybe that's why Ohio State is number one over Indiana, when the metrics suggested that maybe Indiana or even Texas A&M could have been number one. maybe that's why Notre Dame is ranked as high as it is, because they look at it and say, they're just a better team right now. They look better. They're playing better. You can't quantify it. You just have to look at it and understand it. So again, I'm not getting too upset about this. This isn't like DEFCON 1 sort of issues for me right now, but it's certainly a valid point. And Rhodes is the one who opened the door on the topic. And so I think it's legitimate to discuss, but without actually being in that room, who knows, really?
Gino, it's podcast 101 to get outraged.
I know.
You're so measured here. You're so reasonable. Yeah.
No, wait till we get to the last week's picks. I think you'll see a different me.
Okay. Yeah.
Fair.
The pick segment at the end.
Is that getting cut out this week?
No. Well, it needs to be. It needs to be. But we'll address. We'll okay. address it. Yeah. Look, again, we don't know. And boy, it would be great if they did let us in. It would be great if each committee member published their top 25 like the AP voters do.
Yeah,
I realize that's not going to happen, but some more transparency I do think would be helpful. Back in August when they said, you know, we're going to add weight to strength of schedule. We're going to add weight to strength of record. How much weight? You know, what is the weighing? Is everybody supposed to say we're taking 60% of this and 20% of this and 20% of that? Or what? You know, they talk about how they're going to do this, but they don't explain how they're doing it. That's one of my laments here. Now, one more lament. There are no G6 teams in the top 25. Cinderella is dead. Okay, he's dead for this week, or she. Dead for this week. Nobody from the American, which is having a really good season, is in the top 25. Memphis, they said, would be the highest-rated team, but it did not crack the actual rankings. So the non-power programs are dealing with an even higher level of disrespect than usual. How do you guys think, Gene, I'm going to ask you, the P4 commissioners are going to feel if it ends up with a 9-3 or 10-2 AAC champion who's not ranked or is barely in the rankings ahead of the 11th or 12th ranked team from one of their conferences?
You'll be able to fry a very thick porterhouse steak on the foreheads of those people. And I mean, if they get voted off CFP Island for a non-power four team that doesn't have the bona fides that perhaps one of their members does, you'll hear those screams. And you make an excellent point, Pat, because I saw this in Heather Dinich's piece recently, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the fifth highest ranked G5 conference champion gets a spot in the CFP, obviously. But for transparency's sake, as I understand it, the rules don't allow us, the general public, to know where that non-top 25 ranked a non-power four conference champion that's selected to fill in that spot was in the rankings.
Yeah.
So we might not know if that champion was ranked 36th at the time, but they had to move them into that fifth automatic qualifier because those are just the rules. Why is that number not made public?
Great question. I would like to know. I would say this, you know, you know what? We will hear howling probably no matter what, especially if the G6 team either is unranked or even at the tail end of the rankings. But this is also why they want to go to 16, right? Yeah. They want to expand so that their 12th place, 13th place, 14th place teams get in the tournament, because getting in the tournament will be the coin of the realm. And that's whether, you know, you had a successful season. That's where the whole thing is headed. But personally, look, I am still, you know me, I am a populist to the core. I am in favor of a G6 automatic bid. I want to see it. I want that team to have a shot. Boise State got it last year and actually got one of the buys to the quarterfinals. It's a different setup this year. That wouldn't have happened, I don't think, last year. But Boise State acquitted itself pretty well. They lost to Penn State, but they weren't like blown away 55-7. That was a decent game. I was there. I covered it. And I want them to have that chance. Brian, you got anything to add there?
No, but, you know, to Gino's point, you know, I think the thing that we don't get either, and they didn't speak about it afterwards, is, you know, what is the gap between the Memphises of the world to the USF, to Tulane, to any of those teams that are contending for the American, plus James Madison sitting out there, possibly a 12-1 at the end of the year, winning the Sun Belt, having that very close loss to Louisville. You know, are they in the mix for this group of five bid? You know, I think for the committee itself, you know, and if we are saying this is a TV product in terms of the show, they should be drumming up interest in some of those group of five fan bases and saying, hey, it's close at least, you know, like give us that breadcrumb. If you're really considering things, if you're watching those Sun Belt games on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, like just reconfirm that for us. So I think, you know, yes, the somebody's going to be upset by having somebody leapfrog, you know, that group of five champion over somebody that is going to say, hey, we're in the top 12. Why are we not in there? But at the end of the day, I think for the interest level of the sport, it is good for it that we do get that G6 bid into the playoff. And to me, that the committee should play that up a little bit, and maybe they will with the rankings next week in terms of saying, hey, you know what, there's actually more fan bases out there that are in the running for the playoff than you would think. And I think that would be good for the sport overall, especially given all this talk that we've had. It's the Power Four, you know, who's doing this in the SEC, who's in the ACC that might get left out. That to me is going to be bigger for the sport itself if we can get some more interest level from a lot of those G6 leagues.
Sure. That, you know what? These are passionate fan bases. They're not huge, but they're passionate fan bases. Memphis fans are really excited. They've got a chance. Tulane, South Florida, which really has been down for quite a while. So more, a bigger net to pull those fans in is better.
And Pat, one last thing. I'm just saying, if it's a year where one of those G5 teams are bumped up and they're not in the top 25, then I think the committee owes it to all of us just to let us know where they were ranked. That's all. If they were 26, tell us they were 26th.
Sure.
If they were 36, let us know we're 36. Guess what? America loves pulling for an underdog. Yeah. You know, we see it all the time in the NCAAs. We know who the last team is in the NCAAs, and we know where they're seated, and we can do the math. I don't see why the committee can't do the math and let us know if that team is outside that top 25.
I'm with you. And I bet they would say they're 26th no matter what, because they don't want to make it look like they're bringing in somebody who's 43rd.
Yeah.
We'll see. Last playoff related topic, guys. LSU acting athletic director Virge Ausberry, according to new president Wade Rouse. Wade, who came in from McNeese State, quite a charmer, a rural Louisiana charmer. I talked to him when McNeese absolutely pistol whipped Clemson in the tournament last year. He lived in the dorm at McNeese. He's got to move out of the dorm. Maybe they can find him a dorm at LSU. But anyway, says Virge is the acting AD who has full authority to hire the next coach there. But Virge had this to say last week. He said, LSU has to be in the playoffs every year in football. I don't think anybody makes the playoffs every year. You guys feel free to disagree if you want. But my question for you, we'll start with you, Brian. Who comes closest to that level of autopilot? Is it you tell me, just give me a school that you think is the most likely to go to the playoff all the time, even if they don't go to the playoff all the time.
Well, it's got to be Ohio State, right? You know, they've been in every single ranking since way back in 2014 in the initial set. So this is a program that is autopilot. It's almost recession proof. I think that's kind of why people would pencil in this as one of the best, you know, two or three jobs in all of college football, because you know, you can show up, you've got the talent, you have the conference now in terms of the Big Ten and the reputation that league has. You know, you go 10-2, even if you go 9-3, you're going to be in the mix for the playoff if you're a team like Ohio State. So I would go Ohio State easily. You could probably add Alabama in there in terms of, yes, historically, but obviously a lot of that, you know, in the past couple of years has been under Nick Saban. He's no longer there. So there's a new regime in town. So maybe you take Alabama, but if you're talking about autopilot, going to be consistently in every single season, I'm going to go with Ohio State.
Alabama has the most appearances, 8, but they missed in 24 and 22. So even a program like Alabama can miss. Clemson has 7, Ohio State 6, Georgia and Oklahoma 4, Notre Dame and Michigan 3. And obviously the odds increase if they expand the field to 16, which it looks like eventually that might be the next number. But I'm with Brian. I think Ohio State, just basically given their standing in the Big Ten, they are the, you know, the evil empire, the Death Star of that conference, and they're going to be tough to make go away. So I'll agree with you, Brian. I'll say Ohio State too.
Yeah, I'm with you, just because I think there's a little less competition top to bottom in the Big Ten. So that's why I would take them over Alabama or Georgia, which I think both of them I would put there on that next tier. I'd say also Notre Dame has the capability. They may not be able to do it, but you don't have the conference automatic bid, but you also have so much more flexibility in terms of how you arrange your schedule. And they've got things aligned, so to speak, there now as far as how what they really, really want to be good at football. I think there was a period of time where being good at football was important but not vital. And I think now they're back to looking at it as vital. And so I think they should be in the mix every single year.
And you can lose your first two games. Never mind.
Yeah. And still be in the top 10. It's a miracle. It's a miracle.
No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
All right. The coaching carousel, of course, spun another time this week because it does every week. Hugh Freeze out at Auburn. And gosh, he's going to be missed. Yeah, okay. Wow. There's our period of mourning. That's over. Gene, how did it go so wrong for people that thought, and I was probably one of them, I thought Hugh Freeze would do well at Auburn. He did not do well at all. What happened?
Can I remind you of the New Mexico State loss in 2023 for the 4th and goal from the 31 against Bama?
Yeah.
Can I remind you that they hired Hugh Freeze to fix the offense and develop quarterbacks? And he didn't fix the offense, and he definitely didn't develop a quarterback. They lost 4 games, Oklahoma, Texas A&M, Georgia, and Mizzou, by an average of 7.25 points. They wasted a perfectly good defense this year, and they lost to Kentucky and scored 3 points while losing it. But for the next guy, do you remember the last time Penn State, I mean, we make a big deal about Penn State and Notre Dame, right? Remember the last time Penn State won a national championship?
1986.
Okay. Last time Notre Dame won a national championship?
1988.
Right. Last time Auburn won a national championship?
2010.
And played in another one?
2014.
13.
Yeah. Yep.
13, so 14, yeah.
It's a program where if you get the right guy, you can do amazing things there. There's an infrastructure there at Auburn. So let's see if they get the right guy this time. But that's what happened. That's why Hugh Freeze, after 2+ years, is out of there.
I agree completely. You know, and for Hugh's sake, you know, he never found the quarterback. You know, that's kind of why he was brought in the first place. You know, and he stuck with Thorne for too long. You know, Jackson Arnold did not clearly work out this year, and that was the one position you thought, all right, he could at least figure something out there under center, and he never did, and that was why this offense was so bad. You can't blame the defense at this point. You know, I mean, they've got a lot of talent on that defense that was really keeping them in games despite what the offense was doing. The turnover issues, you know, it just, they never looked coherent on that side of the ball, which is not something you would have expected to say about that Hugh Freeze offense, given what we saw at Ole Miss, given what we saw, especially early in his tenure there at Liberty. You know, this was why he was, you know, a hot name for that job when Lane Kiffin turned him down initially. It was all about, hey, he can put together an offense. We know we got talent. We can get talent. That's never been an issue at Auburn. And look at where it's led them. You know, this is, I think, disappointing for not only for Hugh, but I think for everybody at Auburn to say this was not going to work out, because they definitely stuck their necks out for him to make this hire in the first place, and then to have it go so wrong so quickly, certainly looks bad on the Tigers at large.
Yeah, I remember just being astounded when I heard they were actually going all in on the portal to get Jackson Arnold. I just, no respect to the disrespect to the young man, but I never saw anything in him that said, that's the guy you want to build an offense around. And it has not worked. He's last in the SEC in pass efficiency for Auburn, just as he was when he was the quarterback at Oklahoma. It's been some retrofitting that basically that Hugh Freeze got this job because of beating Alabama twice. And that may be the case, but the only reason he beat Alabama the second time when he was at Ole Miss was a ball that deflected off a helmet and turned into a touchdown. Yeah, I was there. I covered the game. It was a crazy fluke play. Yeah, that whole game was crazy, off the rails, weird. But after that same season, beat number 15 Texas A&M, a ranked LSU, a ranked Mississippi State, a ranked Oklahoma State, won 10 games. Hugh Freeze had a lot of success. It wasn't just beating Alabama twice. So I am shocked that he didn't do better there. He was 10-1 at Liberty in 2020, that season. They had, you know, an outstanding offense. So it didn't work.
Who was your quarterback, though?
Then in 2020, they had that really guy. Don't ask me that question. They had an excellent quarterback.
Anyway, as I recall, they had a quarterback who could run his offense.
Yeah.
And that wasn't this guy this year. Again, nothing against him, but he couldn't run what Hugh Freeze was successful at Liberty.
Yeah.
So your point is well taken.
Malik Willis was the quarterback.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Are we confusing the athlete, Malik Willis, with Arnold? No. He ran that offense the way Hugh Freeze wanted it run. It just didn't translate.
All right, Brian, you've been putting together candidate lists for all the open jobs. What do you got for Auburn?
Well, they'd love to go back to the well with Lane Kiffin and see, you know, explore that. But I don't think that's happening, not only given the number of jobs that Lane's going to be up for in the conference itself, but, you know, whether he has that stay or go decision there at Ole Miss, I think is going to be overriding in his mind. And, you know, the usual suspects are going to be mentioned, I think, in this job. And I think it is interesting. I think this is actually the first search that John Cohen, the AD there, is going to be able to conduct on his own, you know, and really lead and shape and go in the right direction versus, you know, you go back to when Hugh Freeze was hired. It was kind of like, all right, we're going to hire John Cohen, and then, you know, boom, they're going to hire Hugh Freeze. And so that was not necessarily he's got the runway to conduct the search as he wants it. But I think they would ideally, you know, want somebody that can, you know, revive that offense. But I go back to what's succeeded there at Auburn, and it has been defensive guys, you know, to be honest, you know, Pat Dye, Tommy Tuberville had an undefeated season. You got Gene Chizik winning that national title most recently. You know, it has been program builders, defensive guys, kind of bring them back to that toughness. And I'm curious if that's going to be something that they're going to look for. That to me John Summerall fits that to a T. He's a guy that's ticketed for the SEC. And I know that the Tulane team just got blown out by Memphis. I get that, but he's 38-11 as a head coach. He knows that state. He's from Huntsville. You know, he knows how to recruit, I think, in that conference. I think he would bring that kind of team building, that toughness back to Auburn. You know, I would be curious about Brent Key. You know, he's from Birmingham. He's obviously had a ton of success right across the road, right across the state line there in Atlanta and at Georgia Tech. Would that tempt him to leave, you know, his alma mater? That would be interesting because I think he would fit that program to a T, bring back that toughness again. And I think if they do go offense, I think Alex Kolisch, you know, given his connections, he helped turn Tennessee around. What he's been able to do, the connections he has now in the state of Florida, that would make a lot of sense from an offensive guy. But, you know, this is going to be an attractive job. You know, it's not, you know, 1A in terms of being up there with LSU in Florida, but it's kind of right there in that next tier. And I think that'll get a lot of interest from a lot of coaches.
Who you got, Pat?
I like Summerall here. But again, I mean, shoot, we'll see. He might end up being first on the list at Florida or something like that. So that's TBD. Although I do think Florida would like to get somebody who's been a head coach in a power conference because they just got a guy from the G6 level and he bombed. So maybe Summerall is gettable for Auburn. I like Brian's point actually about them kind of wanting a defense guy because that's kind of how Auburn rolls to a degree. So I'm going to say Summerall. What do you got, Gene?
Well, I mean, defense wasn't the problem this year.
And no.
Toughness on that side of the ball wasn't the problem this year. Offense was the problem this year. Did anybody happen to watch the Arizona State-Iowa State game last week? What Kenny Dillingham did with without Sam Leavitt, who's done for the year, what he did without when he lost his best wide receiver, one of the best in the country during that game. He coached up a sixth-year senior, and they upset Iowa State. I think Dillingham is a plug-and-play coach in just about any program that's open right now. I think he'd be successful at Penn State. I think he'd be successful at Auburn. I think he'd be successful anywhere you put him. And I could see that feisty, sort of combative personality really endearing himself to those Auburn folks, who always consider themselves a little bit of an underdog. And sure, yes, I know ASU is his alma mater, but if you look at the resources available to him at Auburn versus what he has at Arizona State, with all due respect to Arizona State, I just think Auburn's a better job. And that would be a guy that I would definitely look hard at. And then I think maybe James Franklin could be in play there.
Sure. I mean... I like both those guys. My initial gut reaction is Kenny Dillingham's not going to Auburn. He's going to wait for a better job. But as you outlined, you can't win a national championship at Auburn.
You might be right. You might be right. Yeah. You might wait.
And then Franklin, I think Franklin could succeed in any number of places. The question there is if you can't beat Ohio State, can you beat Alabama? And it's not an apples to apples comparison, but that might be the drawback they're going through there. But there's not that many good candidates for all these jobs. These guys are going to get something if they want something.
Yeah.
Last thing, real quick, rapid fire here. Just give me a name. Speaking of Auburn, they are scheduling Notre Dame 2027 and 2028. Notre Dame's now scheduled that with that. That's 14 out of the 16 teams in the SEC. The only two they haven't played will be Kentucky and Mississippi State. But generally speaking, looking across the landscape, give me one team you want to see the Irish schedule. Gene, you got anybody?
Yes. Yes. How about USC?
Oh, that's what I was going to say.
God, I was going to say the same thing, too.
Oh, man. We're all smart asses.
Okay. You know what? Geographically speaking, and you just mentioned it, I think Kentucky would be a nice choice.
Kentucky would be thrilled. That's for sure. How about Michigan? Go back to playing Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool one.
USC is clearly the choice of others receiving votes. Notre Dame and USC, get it done. All right, it's rant time, fellas. Brian Kelly's gone, and Jeff Landry took the week off from berating people at LSU. So we have an opening for a new ranter. And boy, howdy, we found one. The coach at Boston College, Bill O'Brien, producer Kent. Please play the sound from him nuking a reporter earlier this week.
Coach, I'm wondering, do you have a message for the fans? Obviously losing to Notre Dame, Catholic school rival, 1-8 now in the season BC. I've heard from a lot of fans. They're just really
down. I'm really glad. I'm glad you're down. I'm not down. Nobody's down. We're fighting. We're competing. You know, it's the second year of this program, Mike. You always come in here with these down questions. Like, you show up like once a month or something like that. You come in here with these down questions. I'm not down. I don't know what year you graduated from BC, but this is a program that we're building. Okay. Nobody here's down. We're positive. We're going to show up and play our asses off against SMU. You can go out there in your dark, clouded world or whatever it is and do what you want to do. We're not down. The sun is up, and we're fighting. That's my message to the fans. What's up, Trevor?
How you doing?
What's up, Trevor?
What's the frequency, Kenneth?
Yeah. quite a spirited rant from B.O.B. Gene, I hope the sun is up where you and you're ready to play your ass off. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, that's not even in the top 200 great ass chewings by a coach to a or manager to a reporter, and anybody who's ever been a beat reporter covering a big league team knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm actually a big fan of O'Brien. I think he's a really good coach, and I've gotten to know him a little on the personal side, and I think he's a wonderful person. Now, would that reporter agree with me? Obviously not, but. And he works at he has a really tough job. I mean, there's a reason why they call Boston College the University of Kant. It's a tough place to win, and they don't have the resources. And he is there. He was speaking the truth, but he did it in typical Bill O'Brien fashion. So I thought it was outstanding. I loved it. I'm not sure I would have liked to have been on the receiving end, but I can tell you a very quick anecdote. In 2013, when I was at ESPN, I was part of the crew. We were, it was called Training Days, and we were embedded with Penn State during O'Brien's second season at Penn State. And he wanted us there only slightly less than he wanted shingles, you know? but he was a good sport about it. You know, he let us foam around and all that sort of thing. But one of the things that we had to do at the end, and these were long days, I mean, you know, we had him mic'd up from first thing in the morning till, you know, late at night. And it was, I don't know, day six of this. And my job was to take the crew up to his office at like 10 or 11 o'clock and sort of him put a bow on that day's practices and events. And so I had some stuff I still had to do down in the workroom. And I sent the crew on up. I said, hey, I'll meet you in a few minutes. Well, before I could get up there, the crew's already back. And I go, well, what's the problem? What happened? And he goes, well, O'Brien told us to get the F out of his office. I go, well, what do you mean? He goes, we went in there and we said, we're here to do the, you know, the final interview of the day. He goes, get the F out of here. And so I go, well, hold on. Let me fix this. And the guys like the camera go, no, we are not going to get talked like this. We're adults, and this isn't right. We're out of here. So the crew leaves, just leaves the building. So I run up to O'Brien's office, and he's sitting there, and he's like, well, are we doing this or what? I go, Bill, what just happened? He goes, well, your crew came in, but then they left. I said, they said that you told them to get the F out of your office. He said, well, I was just kidding with them. They're like, well, coach, we're here to do the thing. And I'm like, get the F out of here. And I go, well, they believed you. They left. They're gone. They're not coming back. And he was genuinely, sincerely, you know, like, oh, no, I did not. I mean, look, you know my sense of humor. He has a very dry sense of humor, and they just weren't able to get it. And so, you know, basically we're standing there, and in a weird way, I kind of had to laugh at the absurdity of it all, but that's Bill O'Brien personified.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was, and you know, everybody kissed and made up the next day, but it was one for the books.
Yeah. I think he's an acquired taste to a degree. I mean, he's going to give you some crap,
yeah,
but he'll take it back.
Absolutely.
I think I would put him on the list of guys in his business I would like to have a beer with, because I think he'd be good company.
Yeah, it's a good description.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we can talk about my interaction with Bobby Knight sometime if you want to. An interaction that ended less well. But that's okay. Another topic.
Another show.
Yeah, another show. Speaking of things that did not go well, last week's picks. I wasn't just 0-5, I was actually 0-6. I missed every single pick, and I also predicted we would have indictments in the federal investigation of college basketball by now. That didn't happen either. So, it was a complete disaster. I would like to thank Gunnar Stockton for taking a knee at the one-yard line instead of scoring so Georgia could cover in the cocktail party. Gunnar, I don't care about strategy. I don't care about just winning the game. Good teams win, great teams cover. You hurt me there.
Yeah, but then you would have been 1-4.
I take 1-4. Brian was 1-4. It's better than 0-5. Gene fluked out and went 3-2. And now is
fluked out. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, has got a half game lead thanks to the damn bear. 27-5. Brian 26-5. I have slumped back to 24-7. Interesting week of games. We got one from every power conference, and we'll do a lock of the week. Starting the Big 12. Most interesting game of the week, I think. Undefeated BYU at one loss Texas Tech. Brian Fisher will be there. The Cougars are getting 10.5. Brian, which side are you landing on?
I'm actually not be in Lubbock, but
my bad.
You know, this is a huge line, isn't it? You know, 10.5, especially with that hook there. But I think this is kind of one of those close games for about three and a half quarters, as BYU games usually are. But Texas Tech at the end, whether it's by the back door or whether it's just by that sheer force of will with that defensive line in particular going up against the Cougars, I do think they cover at the end of the day, which is surprising to see. Should be quite the scene there in Lubbock. Probably the best game that stadium has seen since, 2008 or thereabouts. So huge game in Lubbock. I think the crowd will be fired up even though it's an 11 a.m. kickoff, and Tech gets the cover.
No tortillas, though.
No tortillas.
Well, I they're trying to convince me to take BYU, especially with that hook. And guess what? I'll bite. I'll take the 10.5. BYU has shown that they stick around. They play a style of offense that's methodical, and their defense is good enough that I think they hang around for more than three quarters. And yes, Texas A&M, and I'll credit ESPN for these numbers. Texas Tech is 5-0 at home and is home favorites this season, but BYU is 7-1 as an underdog since the start of last season. So in number 47, Brock Meyer, I trust.
There we go. Your quarterback wearing the linebacker number.
The David Pollock number, yes.
Yeah. I'm going to go with BYU as well. It's tough because Texas Tech has been burying people. So they do that. But also, BYU is hard to kill. And I think this is going to be one of those that goes down to the last half of the last quarter, at least from a spread standpoint of where that thing lands. But I'll take the hook. Maybe it is a trap they're inviting me into. I'm walking into it with the Cougars. Big Ten, really interesting game in Kinnick Stadium. Oregon coming in, I think, for the first time, laying 6.5 against a dangerous home underdog in Iowa. Gene, what do you think?
First time Oregon has been at Kinnick Stadium since 1989.
Okay.
So Dan Lanning will get his first look at that pink visitors locker room, which we all love. Ducks have the nation's longest road winning streak at 10. I think it's going to be 11 after Saturday's game, mostly because Lanning and Oregon have had to sit there and listen to, you only beat Wisconsin by 14 at home. Does Oregon even belong in the top 10 or 12 of the CFP rankings? I think this becomes a statement game for Oregon. So I'm taking Oregon, and I'm going to lay those points.
I'm right there with you. You know, give me the Ducks. And I think this could get ugly if Iowa's offense does not come to play, especially in the passing game. I mean, if you can make them one-dimensional, which, you know, I think for all the talk about Oregon's resume not being good, you look at them off getting off the bus. They've got some guys. And I think those guys are going to show up in this game. The weather is a little bit going to be a factor in this one. We saw how kind of bogged down there the Ducks offense got. When it started to actually rain at Austin Stadium, supposed to be rainy, cold, a little, you know, the conditions might be a factor there in Iowa City. But I just think the Ducks are so far superior. I think they're going to be fired up, especially given the break in action that they've had. And they're going to be prepared for this one. They're going to walk in and walk out a winner and covering the 6.5.
Yeah, I'm rolling with the Ducks as well. I think they have superior talent, and they've just got to go in and execute and not get caught in a parent slog where all of a sudden it's 3-3 at halftime and it's punting back and forth. You know, get your guys on track, get your stars going on offense, and they have too many stars. So I'm going with them.
The 1-9 Twins are taking the same team I am. I might have to reconsider.
Look, he's got a half game lead and talking like he's bulletproof here. Great.
I'm sorry. Didn't you mention something about me taking a spa day during the?
Yeah. I didn't see you on that Zoom. Okay. SEC game, Texas A&M at Missouri. A&M is giving 6.5, just like Oregon. I think these games are similar. A&M playing great, but going on the road against a pretty dangerous ranked opponent. A&M laying 6.5. Brian Fisher, what do you think?
Coming off the bye, this you would think with the Aggies, maybe they're a little rusty first half, you know. But I think Mike Elko against a first-time starter at quarterback, and even if Eli Drinkwitz is in his bag and has some things saved up for this game, I still think the defensive line, that front seven for A&M, that makes a difference in this one. Maybe they get a turnover. Maybe they get two turnovers to make this more of a one-way traffic. I think the Aggies go on the road cover, even though this is kind of that spot where you kind of expect, all right, is A&M going to A&M? You know, historically, this, you know, late in the season, Mike Elko's teams have faded. This would kind of be one of those spots you would pick it. But with the first-time starting quarterback, I think it's going to be too much for Mizzou.
Go ahead, Pat.
I'm going with A&M as well. I think that they have weapons that are going to be hard for Missouri to handle. Missouri's defense is good, but Casey Concepcion and Mario Craver at receiver, those guys are big play guys waiting to happen. Get them loose, they can make plays, and I just don't know whether Missouri, with Matt Zollers at freshman quarterback, he played very well in emergency relief of Bo Perbula in Nashville against Vanderbilt, and you do have another week to coach him up. But I almost wonder, sometimes you see this, guys that get thrown in and they're just playing and not thinking at all. Now he's had a lot of time to think, and that may actually work against him. So I'm going to say A&M gets out of there with a touchdown win.
That is incredibly logical, reasonable thinking right there, which is exactly why I'm going to take Mizzou and take those 6.5 points. Because you helped make my point. Mizzou's also coming off a bye week. So they've had 2 weeks to try to get him ready. And yes, I'll be the first to acknowledge that A&M's offense is terrifying. It's scary what those guys on the outside can do. But Mizzou is one of only four teams to rank in the top 15 in total defense, or number 5, in total offense, or number 14. And no, A&M is not one of the other teams. So I think Mizzou can hang around. That game's at Mizzou. I like getting those points in this case.
Special teams could be a factor there, and I like A&M in that regard. 2 punt return touchdowns so far this year for Concepcion. All right. The Karma is a you-know-what bowl in the ACC. Florida State and Clemson. These were the two schools that sued the league to get preferential treatment because they were so far superior to everyone else in the league. Since that, while that was ongoing, last year Florida State went 2-10. Currently, Florida State 1-4 in the conference and in 14th place. And Clemson 2-4 and tied for 12th. Whoops. Hope you can enjoy your good, your extra revenue. By the way, this game is on the CW, which is not even a ratings network, so you're not going to get your revenue from that. Sorry. As for the game, Clemson is giving 2.5. It's at Death Valley. FSU is a 2.5-point underdog. I'm taking Clemson. I have no conviction. Neither team's any good. They're both miserable. But I'm going to say that Clemson finds a sliver of pride here and plays better and gets the victory.
I'm right there with you. Yeah, you know, I'm right there with you. I don't have any conviction. You know, I think if you looked at some of the advanced stats and some of the numbers, they would probably lean Florida State in this one, but I just don't trust the Noles. And I think Clemson at home, night game in Death Valley, that place should be rocking because they know they're going to need the fan support. I think that Clemson defensive line, taking advantage of the Noles offensive line, might be a big factor in this one. So reluctantly going with Dabo and the Tigers.
This is like rummaging through your dirty clothes basket and picking the least stinky t-shirt that you want to wear again.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't trust Florida State. I don't know how you can trust Clemson. Clemson has won 8 of the last 9 versus FSU, but FSU went to Clemson in 23 and won, which means absolutely nothing these days. I'm with you on the no conviction train. But I'm going to go ahead and take FSU in those 2.5 points. Why? Absolutely zero idea. It's like I'm headed for 40 territory this week.
Man, the abuse I take on this show, it's incredible. I will say it is interesting watching our producer, Kent. Kent logs in the picks, and I can see on the Google Doc. And he basically tries to kind of listen to what we're saying and predict. And so he starts to erase one or the other. Gene always keeps him guessing. Down to the last second there, but producer Kent doing a good job keeping us on task here. Lock of the week, who has one?
Go ahead, Gino.
Well, Washington is at Madtown for the first time in 57 years, even though the beer sales numbers were a little off. It should be a beer consumption game. Wisconsin is getting 11.5 points. They put up a respectable effort for them at Oregon. So that's something. They did cover the 30 points, but I don't think it happens this week. Washington, even though it's traveling across the country, is actually getting a fairly humane kickoff time. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. Both teams are coming off the bye. I just don't see how Wisconsin's god-awful offense keeps up with what Damon Williams can do with Washington. I think this is a blowout game, and Washington covers.
I have to say, if the show did nothing else this week, we got Gino to say Wisconsin about 8 times, so that's good. That keeps our readers or our listeners coming back, I believe.
If that's what keeps our listeners coming back, we got a real issue.
We have issues. We got a lot of issues.
All right.
We're working. We're trying to get better.
So I'll take I'll give the 11.5 and take a Washington.
Brian?
We're going back out west again. We'll see if any of the three of us can stay up for this game. San Diego State is at the Islands. They are getting seven.
That's a hard
points.
No.
you know, so another touchdown for San Diego State. I think things are clicking for Sean Lewis's team, especially offensively. They've got one of the best defenses in the Mountain West. Give me the Aztecs to cover the 7 out there at Hawaii, especially after Hawaii's also made back-to-back trips to the mainland. So they're going to be pretty tired for this one as well. So I don't think travel is going to be the issue. Give me the Aztecs.
I like both the picks, and I almost took Washington myself. I did in my picks that I have to make for SI. I like them in that game. But I think I found Sean Lewis's burner account on Twitter, by the way. I termed Kent State as a walkover for somebody, and all of a sudden I'm getting replies like, that's a cheap shot. It's like, no, it's actually true. I looked, and the guy is a big fan of San Diego State, too. He was defending Kent State and is a big fan of San Diego State. I'm putting 2 and 2 together. Sean Lewis Burner, I'm on to you. All right. My lock of the week. Guess what? I'm going back where I was wildly mocked for doing it before, but I'm taking North Carolina. They're at home against Stanford. Stanford is a bad road team. North Carolina is playing better, as we have noted. They punished Syracuse, won 27-10, and that was a take-a-knee situation to keep it from being 34-10. I'm giving a hook. It's 7.5. I wish it were 7 or 6.5, but fine. You know what? I'm rolling with Chapel Bill. He's got it going. Jordan Hudson, everything, the vibes are all good. We're going with the heels in the hoodie to cover the 7.5. All right, last thing, guys. I brought this up before in regards to Halloween. We talked about the runaway pumpkin, the giant inflatable pumpkin in, I think it was in Ohio. And, you know, it was like 4 weeks or whatever before Halloween. And, my point was, why the hell do you have your pumpkin out that early, your inflatable pumpkin? Well, it's walking the neighborhood here Sunday night, November 2nd. Come across a house lit up for Christmas like Danny DeVito's in that one movie where, you know, you're trying to be visible from space on November 2nd. You know, I was so aghast. I was so taken back. I was shocked. I figured, okay, you know, maybe the weather's warm and you want to get the lights up now, you know, just in case it turns bad. But do you have to turn them all on? Oh, yes, you've got to turn them all on. And not only that, you got to have the tree up already, and the tree is up in the front window. Am I a miserable Christmas-hating schmuck, or do I have the right to egg these people's house? Justice Wojciechowski, do you have an opinion?
I will. If eggs weren't so expensive, I would send you a carton and maybe even drive to Louisville and help you out with that. The weather thing, living in Chicago most of the year, yes, that's a real thing. You want to get them up before your hands freeze when you're trying to attach those little plastic things to the gutters for the lights. Totally get it. Under no circumstances do you turn that switch on. You just don't. That's embarrassing. So I support you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Brian?
Well, I think you'll be thrilled to know that on November 1st, my wife made me get the Christmas trees out for the house. Now, we have not gone external with any of this. Thankfully, okay. We had those permanent lights, so I don't have to do that. So I'm not turning anything on externally, but the wife has already got the Christmas stuff up, much to my chagrin, because I think this is really a plague on our society as of late, the Thanksgiving erasure. Especially as football folks, we know how important that is important a holiday it is in the sport of football. I feel like we continually gloss over Thanksgiving. So let's give that holiday back its respect and stop overlooking it in favor of Christmas. We got a whole month of Christmas.
That's when you would put up the tree.
Yes.
Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for speaking up for Thanksgiving. The aggression towards Thanksgiving will not stand on this podcast. It's way too important, and the food is too good. It needs its place. You can't just steamroll over it and go straight into Christmas mode. I'll ask you this now, Brian. If you've got the Christmas stuff out, how long will it stay up after Christmas?
Well, you know, given our schedule, with multiple rounds of the playoff, it might go until January, the end of January there. Maybe there might be some time between the semifinals and the title game. But, you know, we got NCAA convention, everything going on in January. It might stay up a while. I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, these people, I believe, will have their lights on for 3 straight months. It'll be all of November, all of December, and all of January.
Pat, I'll introduce them to my wife, Cheryl, who, like, on the 26th of December, she's like, Christmas is over. Get it down. Let's go. Get the stuff down. Yeah. Yeah, we're done with this.
My wife's pretty much the same. She may let it go to New Year's, but, like, she's a 3 weeks before, 1 week after, boom, pow, we're done. So
exactly.
Yeah. I watch and say, good job. All right, clearly that's enough of this show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Leave us a review if it's a nice one. If not, please don't. We'll be back next week. We'll try to do better. Have a good week.